welcome to episode 75 of Did You Bring the Hummus podcast. I'm Kimberly, your host, and I'm super excited to be here with you today. Did You Bring the Hummus is a podcast to help you go vegan. Most importantly, we'll talk about how to embrace this meaningful decision with fervor and fun. Episodes post every Monday on your favorite podcast app. Before we get started, I have one very important question for you. Did you bring the hummus? Episode 75. Wow. It's also the final episode of season 4. Friends, this is a good one. I mean, they're all good, but this is like quite a way to end a season. Don't worry, I'll be back before you know it with season 5. I'll keep you posted on when it goes live. Today, I am joined by the one and only Peter Singer. Peter is recently retired from his role as Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University, though when this episode was recorded, he was teaching his final semester. Peter is often referred to as the father of the modern animal rights movement. Journalists tagged him as the world's most influential living philosopher. Peter believes this is attributed to the work within the ethical treatment of animals and of the influence that his writing has had on the development of effective altruism. When I mentioned to a friend that I would be interviewing Peter, they said to me, "That guy is pretty controversial. I mean, would he be a philosopher if he wasn't?" Peter attributes statements like this to his controversial critique of the sanctity of life ethics in bioethics. He is the author of Animal Liberation and the updated Animal Liberation Now, and several other books on rights, effective altruism, and more. I have to tell you, if newly vegetarian 21-year-old me knew that so many years later, I would have had a one-on-one conversation with Peter Singer, well, I'm not sure what I would have done, but I highly doubt I would have believed it. Just a quick note before we get into the interview. I can't believe that season 4 is already wrapping up. I can't believe that I'm at episode 75. And I am so, so thankful to you, my amazing listeners, to all of these incredible guests that I've been able to have these intimate, incredible conversations with. I don't know how I wound up doing this amazing thing, but I am so glad every day that I am. Let's get into it. Hi, Peter. Welcome. I'm so glad you could join me today.
Hi, Kimberly. I'm happy to be with you.
This is fantastic. We're going to have such an interesting conversation. Just a little background for you about me. I decided to study philosophy and have a degree in philosophy. And part of it was inspiration from reading Animal Liberation. So I had been a psych major. And I took a break because school is expensive. And I took a break. And while I was on that break, I went vegetarian because I had gotten an issue of PETA's Animal Times in the mail. Mm-hmm. And while I was learning, I didn't know anything about being vegetarian. I didn't know how to cook. I didn't like vegetables. So I started reading and looking at what could help me understand what I was doing. And I found Animal Liberation. It was the first book that I read, and it like re-sparked my interest in philosophy so much so that when I got back to school, that was what I decided to major in.
That's great. I'm delighted both with you being a vegetarian, of course, and the fact that you went to do philosophy is influenced by my work. I think it's terrific that people go into philosophy with ideas about how it intersects with real life, because mm-hmm. so many people see it as something up in the clouds, and it isn't. It really changes lives all the time. It's great.
Absolutely. So the very first question that I ask every one of my guests is to share your vegan journey. Tell us how you got to where you are now.
Okay, so my journey started in 1970 when I was a graduate student at the University of Oxford, attending various classes, but eating meat and complaining with other Australians about how the meat in England isn't really very good compared to the meat in Australia. And then I happened to start to speak after a class with a Canadian graduate student called Richard Keshen. And we were talking about whether we have free will and what its implications are for responsibility. And he said, why don't you come and continue to have lunch with me in my college, because it was just lunchtime, and we'll continue the discussion over lunch. So I said, fine, let's do that. We went to the college, and at that time, there was just one hot dish option, and that was spaghetti that had some kind of brown sauce on top of it. And Richard said, can you tell me, is there meat in that sauce? And he was told that there was. And then he took the only other option, which was a cold salad plate. So I took the spaghetti. It looked like it was going to fill me up a bit better than the salad plate. And we continued our conversation about free will. But after that seemed to have, you know, reached the point that those conversations and I get to where we weren't going to get a lot further. I said, so why did you ask that question about meat? What's your problem with eating meat? You have to remember, this is 1970. Mm-hmm. Richard was not somebody from a Hindu background. I was surprised that he was a vegetarian. You didn't meet very many vegetarians other than perhaps people from India at that time. So, and I didn't know what to expect really, but I thought I'd probably expect something pretty cranky that I wasn't going to agree with. But he said something very straightforward, like, I don't think it's right to treat animals the way that the animals that we turn into meat are treated. And I said, well, why not? Aren't they out in the fields all day, protected from predators? You know, the farmer makes sure they get fed. Yeah, sure, I know they get tracked to slaughter and that must be horrible, and slaughter's probably not very nice either, but it's one bad day and a good life. And Richard said, no, it's not like that. Lots of the animals are being brought indoors. They're very crowded. The point of the enterprise is just to produce them as cheaply as possible. There's no real attention paid to their well-being. And I said, you know, I was surprised. I said, really? How do you know all this? And he referred to some friends who got this from, but he also mentioned a book by a woman called Ruth Harrison called Animal Machines. And it was the only book, I think, at the time that actually described factory farming with a view to what impact is it having on the animals. I read it, and it was pretty shocking, and it was hard to challenge because it was full of quotes from farming journals. And they showed that, you know, I mean, it was saying things like, you know, treat the hen like a machine, converting low-priced fodder into high-priced eggs, maintain the machine as cheaply as you can, basically. And then there were questions about how many hens can you get into one of those small wire cages? And it was obvious that the reason why you might not put more in was because they were going to die. But as long as they were still alive and laying eggs, that was okay. Mm. So that was disturbing. And under influence of Richard and a couple of other Canadian friends who were also in Oxford, that he mentioned, who were also vegetarians, I talked to Renata, my wife, about it. She was there with me. And we decided that we were going to stop eating meat. So that was certainly the beginning of the journey. The journey to being vegan took a long time because at that stage, well, I'd never heard of the word vegan at that point. I did eventually find out that there were some vegans. There was a vegan society in England, which I think had 300 members. But that still seemed a bit, you know, too way out for me. And so it took a long time. And, you know, some people will argue with me. I don't think, for example, that it's really wrong to eat oysters because I don't think oysters are sentient beings. And I don't think their environment, the way they're produced, arguably is environmentally beneficial for cleaning the waters. So although, you know, I can't remember when I last ate an oyster, but I don't object to eating oysters. I might if there was nothing else around. And, you know, although, as I say, my wife went vegetarian with me 53 years ago or whatever, she hasn't gone vegan. She's still attached to we generally in the house we don't use dairy milk, we use you know, soy or one of those milks. And we try, you know, she still eats a bit of cheese. I mean, cheese from cows. I don't, and I don't, I'm not very keen on the vegan cheeses as yet. They may improve still. I hope I have tasted some better ones, but they're not really on the market yet.
I spent a long time being vegetarian too. It was about 14 years. And I would go vegan here and there, and then I'd end up eating pizza or, you know, something that had cheese on it. And then all of a sudden, all the chemicals from the cheese were working on me again. And I was back to being vegetarian, but I finally went vegan in 2015. Cause you know, for me, I just like a lot of what you talk about in animal liberation and animal liberation now is like, I just can't justify what I'm contributing to by eating it, no matter how much I think I might love pizza and no matter how much a vegan cheese is better now for sure, but it, you know, it can leave something to be desired, I guess, that way. Do you think it's necessary that we have eggs?
No, I don't think it's necessary at all. I think we could do without it, but unfortunately people are still wanting it and they're not ready to shift away from it. So this is, you know, part of my worry about insisting on people being pure vegans is that it makes it harder for other people to move towards it. If you give people the impression that unless they're pure vegans, they're just doing the wrong thing, then maybe they will just throw up their hands and say, yeah, you know, it's too hard. I'm not going to bother. I'll just buy whatever I feel, you know, see in the supermarket. And I would prefer if people felt that they were getting somewhere by at least cutting out the factory farm products, which seems to me to be the greatest evil as far as both what we do to animals and what we do to the planet is concerned.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, as much as I love the idea of having a vegan world, living in a vegan world and having us all following that philosophy, like, I understand that we are not there yet. And, you know, I've had people apologize for eating animals in front of me. The vegan in me is like, yeah, come on. It's actually not that bad. I learned how to cook. I eat this way. It's really easy. But I understand too. I don't want to be the person that makes them throw up their hands, like you said. And I do think that it's more effective if we can guide people along the path with the hope that they'll all go vegan.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. We want to guide them. Certainly. I agree with all of that. It's nice that people are apologizing to you, but they're concerned about offending you, right?
Right.
They're concerned about supporting the systems that they're producing. And and of course, if they say, I don't eat beef anymore, I've, you know, eat more chicken. I mean, that's worse, right? There's more animal suffering, more animals being eaten and worse conditions for the animals. We shouldn't allow people to get away with that. And the other thing they say, of course, is, oh, I only eat fish now, but that's also pretty terrible, especially so much of the fish is also factory farmed. It's just factory farmed underwater.
I think that's almost lost on a lot of people, just how many fish, billions, right, are involved in that process. And I mean, there's like 8 billion land animals, I think, a year in factory farm system.
It's about 9, but that's just the United States. No,
and I laugh because that's horrific, not because it's funny. Yeah,
it's horrible. Yeah, no, I think the figures are, if you're talking about, firstly, let's say we're talking about vertebrate animals, although some invertebrates clearly can feel pain, and we shouldn't be eating octopus or lobster either. But even if we forget about them for the moment and just focus on the vertebrate, land animals, it's something over 80 billion worldwide. And if we bring in the fish, the last and best estimate of fish I've seen is, and this is again just factory farm fish, this is not wild caught fish, is something like 124 billion. So you add these together, you're over 200 billion vertebrate individuals being factory farmed and then killed. And then with the fish, because we eat, particularly we in the West, not so much in some other countries, we eat carnivorous fish, So, you know, you if you buy a salmon, firstly, that salmon has been living in, you know, circling around in these nets, very crowded, probably infested with sea lice, because that's a problem when you have thousands of them together. So that salmon has suffered for its life, but it's had to be fed fish. And those fish, the trawlers go out in the ocean, they haul up these huge nets of small fish, but still also sentient beings who die slowly, suffocating or crushed to death in the net. And a study has shown that the average 4 kilo, so it's about 8 pound salmon, has been responsible for 147 fish being caught and ground up and fed to it. So, you know, you look at that one piece of salmon on your plate and there's a lot more suffering behind it than you're seeing.
Yeah. And bycatch too, right? If they're using the...
as well. Yeah. That's pretty, yeah.
That's a lot to take in.
Yeah. But I wish, you know, well, it's great that your audience is taking this in. I hope they'll spread it and they'll say something about it to their fish eating friends, who presumably some of them will still have.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so too. So Animal Liberation Now. Animal Liberation first came out in 1975, right? And yeah. Then you revised it in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have another version here in 2023. First question, what made you write Animal Liberation and why a new edition now?
So I wrote it because I thought the public needs to know about this. At first, I thought that one of my Canadian friends was going to be writing it, and so I didn't do anything about it for a while. And they actually produced a collection of essays called Animals, Men, and Morals, which I regard as, in a way, the first book in the animal liberation movement, although because it was a collection of essays, there wasn't a consistent viewpoint across all the essays. But if you read the right essays, you could find the elements of it there. But it was completely ignored by the, they brought it out in, it was published in England first. It was completely ignored by the English media press. Mm-hmm. So, you know, didn't get a review in any of the newspapers, got a one paragraph notice in one of them. That was all it did. And so, of course, nobody knew about it. It didn't sell at all. And that was very disappointing. And then my friends had the good news that there was an American publisher who was going to publish Animals, Men, and Morals. So I thought, this is great, but maybe the same thing is going to happen again. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, is there something I could do to help it? And by this time, I was no longer a graduate student. I had a very junior, my first academic position at the University of Oxford. I got some stationery from, you know, the college that I was at the University of Oxford, and I wrote to Bob Silvers, the editor of the New York Review of Books, because I thought, if there's one place that is sort of progressives will read and see something about this new book, it would be the New York Review of Books. Mm. And somewhat to my surprise, I wrote and described what the book was about and what I would write about it. And somewhat to my surprise, he said, you know, well, sounds interesting. Send it in. We'll see.
All right.
So that was enough encouragement. So I wrote about a 4,000-word essay, I think it was, describing the book, and I called the essay Animal Liberation, which was not phrased in the book, but I was trying to make the parallel with what was then known as the Women's Liberation Movement, mm-hmm. now the Feminist Movement, and the Black Liberation Movement, and the Gay Liberation Movement was also around. So I was trying to say, this is another of these movements about an oppressed group of beings. Mm-hmm. Silvers liked it and published it, and I got a number of letters that were positive, and among them was one from Simon & Schuster, an editor at Simon & Schuster, which was quite a prominent American publisher then. And she said, you know, this is an interesting article. Maybe there's a book in it. Would you like to write something? Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, this is encouraging. Yes, okay, I'll have a go at doing that. So I produced an outline and I think two sample chapters maybe, and I sent it off to her, and I got a letter back saying, I can't remember her name now, that she had left Simon & Schuster, and there was nobody at Simon & Schuster who was interested in this project. So that was very disappointing, but around that time, I had actually, my temporary junior appointment at Oxford had expired, and I had got another visiting position at New York University. So I actually went to, was in New York then. And I sort of contacted, well, maybe Robert Silvers had actually asked me to review something else. And I said, by the way, I'm now in New York. It would be nice to come and say hello. And so he invited me for lunch. And I told him the sad story about Simon and Schuster and the fate of their proposal. And he said, you know, we occasionally publish books that grow out of our articles. Maybe you'd like to do it with us. And I said, oh, terrific. So not only did they publish it, but I, you know, Robert Silvers was a legendary editor, and he was really great at sort of pushing me to make sure that I was clear, to he put up objections to me that I needed to answer. So that was great. And Animal Liberation came out with them in 1975.
That's awesome.
Then you had another question, which is why did I revise it or something? Was that right? What happened?
Yeah. So why a new version this year in 2023?
Yeah, well, really, because as you said, there was the 75 version, there was the 1990 update. But by around 2020, that 1990 update was 30 years old. Mm-hmm. If you looked at the chapter on animal experiments, for example, you might say, hey, it's 2020 and all of these experiments happened at the latest in the 1980s. That's not very relevant to what's going on today. And although it wasn't quite so obvious, the factory farm references were also obviously from the 80s and earlier. And there'd been a lot of change in both areas. So I thought if this book is going to remain relevant for, you know, another decade or two, it needs to be updated. And 2020, I was 74. So I thought, I better do it soon. so it was around then that I started working on it. It took quite a long time. There's a lot of factual material to update, as well as going through all the arguments and a lot of other things that have been written around the area since then. So it was quite a lot of work, but I'm very pleased that I did it, and the book is there, and it will hopefully be around for a few years.
Yeah, for sure. I just read through it again over the weekend. It's like every time you read it, there's something else that just kind of is staggering, or, you know, makes you wonder how are humans capable of what they're capable of? And it really goes both ways, right? We see in this book the intense cruelty that humans can create and engage in. And then we think about the movement and the way things have changed, and we can see the beauty and the power that humans are capable of to change things in a positive, beneficial way. So while it's hard information to get through, I felt by the end quite a bit of hope. And I appreciate that it's kind of laid out that way.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair account of what the book is saying. Some of the things that I describe are really shocking. Shocking that people can do this, that they can treat sentient beings in this way. But very often that's because it's such a mass system. You know, the people who are producing chickens, there's 20,000 birds in a shed. They've been bred to grow extremely fast. They have all kinds of deformities. They collapse on the ground and can't move, and so on. And then what do you do with them? You know, I remember that there's somebody I describe, take from another article. I think an undercover investigator worked in the chicken farm, and he's just picking up these sick and injured birds because they're not going to make it to the time when they need to be taking a slaughter. So he's picking them up and he's dropping them through a trapdoor in the ground where there's basically a hole in the ground that's covered up. He's not killing them. And the person says something like, well, wouldn't it be better to wring their necks first? And he says, look, there's so many of them, you don't have time. If you do that, you'll be here all day. Mm-hmm. And he's just dropping them in and they're slowly dying in the darkness. I mean, he makes some remark like there's a lot of chicken soup down there or some facetious remark. Yeah. But it's hard to think of people doing that, but the people who are doing that, I guess, are themselves probably, they get psychologically damaged by what their work entails, and that's what they're doing to earn a living. So that's the negative side of it. And then there are all these And it's one of the great things about being part of the animal movement is you meet a lot of wonderful people. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who are really committed to change, who know that they're really not getting a lot of personal reward for it, other than the satisfaction of knowing that they're trying to help helpless sentient beings. I think that's really encouraging. And yeah, we have been making some progress, definitely in the United States, a little bit less than in the European Union or the United Kingdom, I would say. Mm-hmm. But even here, you know, there are some states, a dozen or so states maybe, that have enacted legislation to get rid of the battery cage and get rid of some of the worst forms of confinement. Mm-hmm. That's not enough, but it shows that we can achieve something. And because it's happened in states where there is the possibility of a citizens' initiated referendum, when that happens, when we can put the facts before the American people, they are opposed to what we're doing to animals in factory farms by quite large majorities often. That's good. That's encouraging. But it's the American political system is also corrupt at various levels where you can't have citizens initiated referenda, and the lobbyists and the money make it very difficult to get any animal welfare legislation for farmed animals, at least, out of the federal government.
Right. So since it is so systemic, we don't have the ability in all ways, like you were just saying, to kind of step in and be like, hey, this is what we actually want. You know, listen to the people. The people want something different than what you're doing. What do we do to keep moving things forward?
Well, I mean, I think we have to work on the corporations here, whereas in Europe, they can have better hopes of influencing their parliaments and getting national legislation. And some legislation has occurred, as I said, so we can do perhaps more still in that direction. But I think the more effective things here have been putting pressure on the corporations to change their practices. So, you know, particularly those that are in contact with the public and are serving animal products, so the fast food chains, we can try and get them to at least stop using eggs from caged hens. We can stop using pig products from those systems in which the mother pigs are in stalls that they can't really move, they can't turn around, they can shuffle a step, half a step forward or backwards, and that's all they have to do all day. So we can try and educate the public about that and get the fast food chains, the supermarkets, as many, the large-scale catering companies, as many as possible to say, no, this is not good enough. We need to raise the standards.
Mm-hmm. For those of us who, you know, and most of my listeners are not yet vegan, so they're the ones who are giving their money to places like this. So if they are asking for something different, and they receive a response, maybe, you know, we're working on that, or we're not working on that, that's not really a priority. Do you encourage then people to then spend their money elsewhere? What can they do? Do they keep fighting that, or do they just go, okay, I'm going to actually buy stuff from somewhere else, and then maybe they'll feel it in their pocket?
Yeah, certainly don't. Yeah. I mean, don't buy the products that you know would make you complicit in. And particularly the factory farming, but keep asking. So actually, there's a new Japanese store opened here in Princeton, where I am now. And so I walked in and I looked at their sushi. And what do I find? There's no vegan sushi. And I say to the person there, a Japanese woman, I said, you don't have any vegan sushi here. And she said, oh yeah, we have California roll. And I say, but it has imitation crab meat in it. And imitation crab meat, it's not crab, but it's fish. And she said, oh, yes, that's right. She said, well, we'll do something about that. But I've been back three times, and each time I ask her, you know, but as long as I'm here, I'm going to keep hassling her. You know, it's not that I won't buy any products in that store. I will. I have, you know, a seaweed salad or something like that. It's fine. I think try to keep up the pressure and eventually, maybe people will get the message that you would buy more if they had more vegan products.
Mm-hmm. Same thing at restaurants, right? If Absolutely. If we're going somewhere and they don't have a great vegan option, then we should just keep asking and even say, okay, well, if you can't, you know, give me more than a plain, boring salad, then, you know, maybe I'll just eat elsewhere. And
exactly, you know. Right. Yeah, yeah. Or if there, yeah. Even if there's only, you know, one vegan option, I mean, you know, if I'm eating there with my wife, we like to taste each other's dishes. So, you know, one may not be enough. We might still go elsewhere. You know, if you're with a group of people and also and you're all ordering the same thing, it's, there should be a choice. And I think, I mean, probably it depends a lot where you live, but my impression is that things have got much better in the last few years in that respect.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, another thing that I really appreciate about Animal Liberation, you know, so much, I think now when we talk about veganism, people immediately go to food and they want to know, what are you eating? And what do you mean animals are mistreated? How does that happen? It's so focused on food. But the first section of Animal Liberation is about animal testing and vivisection. For me, I actually stopped buying products that had been tested on animals before I stopped eating them. I was a teenager. I was in high school. And my first encounter with the Jeremy Bentham quote that you have at the beginning of the book was actually at the store called The Body Shop.
All right.
Yeah. They had a logo in the window. It said, against animal testing. It's got two rabbits, one on each side. And then underneath it says, the question is not, can they reason or can they talk, but can they suffer? And it had Jeremy Bentham's name there. And I was like, what is this? I'm very interested in what this means. And I started buying all of my products that, you know, that I could at The Body Shop, because it was so clear that things weren't tested on animals. And I didn't know exactly what they meant by testing on animals. I just knew that didn't sit well with me. And so I think that we're not talking enough. And then this is really maybe more anecdotal because it's my experience, but people ask me about food all the time, but people aren't asking me about what kind of product should I be using instead? Like, what makes something not vegan from a product perspective? And just reading through what animals endure for our shampoo, for our makeup, for medicine is horrific. And I appreciate that there's a lot of information in here about that as well, to remind people, like, hey, veganism isn't just about what we're eating. This is an ethical stance, a moral philosophy, and a whole way for us to live. And so we can actually use veganism to help us make decisions about everything in our life. And that includes where else animals show up and where else they're being abused by humans in order for us to have things that we like or we want.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Again, it's, you don't want to make people's lives too complicated, I think. You know, when you get into things like, oh, I'm buying a car. So what was the glue used that holds the seat fabric mm-hmm. down, something like that, right?
And, right. So
you can avoid the leather seats, but it's very hard to be completely pure. So
yeah.
It's, you know, I try to allow some flex there. I don't think it's like a sort of religious doctrine where somehow, you know.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. That's not what I meant at all. Yeah. I like how it's a very easy guideline, I think, to go, okay, I feel this way. I want to make sure I'm reducing as much suffering as I can. And it is important that people realize, hey, we don't live in a vegan world. Even people who are, I am the most perfect vegan, it's not even possible to be the most perfect vegan, because there are animal products in everything. I mean, who asked when I bought a car in 2018, I didn't ask them about the glue. I know that there's typically animal products in the tires, but it doesn't have leather seats. Right. I did what I could, and I need to have a car.
Yep. You know? I think that's right. I think that's a really good,
I guess I was trying to say just that it can actually make it easier to make decisions when you kind of have this moral philosophy kind of guiding you.
Yeah. It gives you a guide. Sometimes it reduces the choices, but that's not a bad thing either, because this society provides us with such a plethora of choices that sometimes can drive you mad. Not bad to have. Okay, I don't need to think about those ones anyway.
Yeah. I think humans can be so exhausted, just especially, here in the US, we can just be exhausted because there's just too many things to decide between.
Yeah.
You've been doing this for a long time, like we just covered. Do you still feel hopeful? And in the moments when things are hard, you're faced with just how dark things can still be, where do you pull that hope from?
I certainly still remain hopeful. I still have a belief in the long run moral progress of our species. I think if you zoom out to take a long enough perspective, you go back hundreds or even thousands of years, we have made a lot of progress in morality over that period. It's not been steady progress. It's more like the stock market. It rises a bit, then it falls back a bit, then it rises a little bit more than the previous peak, and so on. So in general, I think we have. I think at the moment we are in a trough in some ways. Certainly the wars that are going on at the moment, just looking at broadening out from being vegan to the world as a whole, those are very depressing. The fact that we're not doing enough about climate change is pretty depressing. So sometimes it is hard. And of course, if you really wanted to get depressed about animals, you think about China and the fact that China becomes a much larger producer and consumer of animals than it was before it achieved its present economic relative prosperity anyway. Certainly became a sort of middle income nation rather than a low income nation. So that's enabled people to use their money to buy more meat, and that's meant more factory farming. That's all pretty depressing. But I still think that the movement is in the right direction towards expanding the circle of our moral concerns from our own tribe, if we go back thousands of years, to larger communities, a city-state, a nation, eventually to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the idea of considering all human beings, avoiding racism and sexism. And of course, we're not there yet either with those, but again, we've made a lot of progress if you think about the bad old days. So I think we will get there with animals, but it will still be a long time to come. And then finally, to get to your point about sort of how do you maintain hope? Well, you do look at the positives that have been achieved. You look at the people who are working hard to achieve more victories and are achieving more victories. And I think that's what gives you hope.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I like that. Thank you. One of the things that I hear a lot, and it's mentioned in your book too, is the idea that because I'm vegan and I'm motivated by my interest in reducing suffering and caring for animals, that means that I don't care about people or other causes. And also, if I'm so concerned about animals and their abilities to have rights, does that mean that I think that my cats should have equal voting rights or the same types of things that I am able to benefit from? And you talk about equal consideration. Can you explain what you mean by equal consideration for the listeners?
Yeah, certainly. I think this is the fundamental moral principle of equality, not just for animals, but for humans as well. Mm-hmm. Because obviously humans differ in a whole lot of ways. We're not equal in a factual sense. We're equal in a moral sense. And what is that moral sense? Well, I think it's the fact that we can all live good lives in the right conditions, fulfilling, enriching, rewarding lives, or we can live miserable lives in which we're suffering, we're in distress, we're oppressed. The principle of equality is saying, well, it's equally important for all of these people that their lives not be filled with suffering, but that they be as good as they can be. And you know, whether you're black or white, male or female, those are the things that matter. Now, that is, I think, a basic principle on which you can make arguments about human equality and develop them from there. But because it talks about interests we have in living lives that are good for us and not suffering pain and distress, it actually isn't limited to human beings. Mm-hmm. It's a principle that clearly can and ought to be applied to any being who's capable of feeling pain, capable of suffering, capable of having a life that for them is a good life. Mm-hmm. So the principle of equal consideration of interest says that we should give equal weight to similar interests, no matter not only what race or sex the species, the being is, but also what species the being is. And that means that the pain of a cat, let's say, or a cow or a pig or a mouse being used in an experiment matters as much as similar pains of any other being. Now, exactly what counts as similar pains is going to be more difficult to say exactly, because beings differ, and they may differ in their capacity to experience pain in ways that we can't grasp. But equal consideration of similar interests is the moral principle that underlies that. And then we want to look at what, as I say, what kinds of interests beings have. But in general, I think if we're talking about beings who are capable of feeling pain, then there are going to be at least some cases where we can say, you're inflicting so much pain on this animal or so much suffering, and the benefit to humans, if there is a benefit to humans at all, which there may not be, but if there is supposed to be a benefit to humans and that's why you're doing it, is so slight that even without doing any exact comparisons, it's just obvious that we're causing more suffering than we should be. And that, I think, is clearly the case with factory farming. You know, we don't need to eat these products. They're not necessary for our survival. They don't actually increase the amount of food available to our species as a whole, because you have to grow the grains or the soy or catch the fish and grind them up and feed them to the animals, because you've taken them off the fields and put them inside so they can't get their own food. So in all of those counts, it also contributes to forest clearing and greenhouse gas emissions. On all of those counts, it's a bad thing to do. And what do we get out of it? Well, some of us anyway, like the taste and the sort of chewiness of it better than they like the taste and chewiness of plant-based foods. But, you know, the marginal difference there is really quite small. So I don't think that can possibly justify the prolonged suffering that we inflict on the animals.
Right. You spend 5 minutes maybe eating a part of an animal, and their entire lives have been filled with pain and suffering.
Yeah.
And
That's right. Like, that's the kind of calculation. And that's why, even though we don't have precise ways of comparing the suffering of cows or pigs or chickens with our own, we don't need them to reach that judgment that you just reached.
Yeah. Hmm. What do you see as the most effective form of advocacy?
I think there are different forms that are effective in different ways. One thing that everybody can do and that has been shown in surveys to be effective is talk to your friends, because, you know, surveys have been done where they ask people, so what is it that led you to become a vegan or a vegetarian? And the most common answer is talking to a friend. So that's clearly effective, even if you can only do it on a relatively small scale, but it's worth doing. But you have to do it in a non-preachy, non-self-righteous way, right? You have to do it as a positive encouragement, not a scold, to try to get people to see a better alternative. So I think that's important. But I'm sure there's lots of other things that are important, and they range from producing documentaries or writing letters to the editor of your local papers, you know, all of those things may make people more aware, to investing hundreds of millions of dollars in plant-based and foods and cellular or cultured meat foods, which, you know, incidentally, would be another way in which I'm not a vegan, because when I was in Singapore a few months ago, I ate some chicken, but it was not chicken from a chicken. It was chicken that was grown from cells in a bioreactor. And because Singapore is the first country in the world to actually permit that legally, when I was there, I wanted to see what it was like. Didn't feel that I needed to eat any more of it once I found out what it was like. But you know, I hope that that technology develops. I hope it becomes cheaper than it is now, because it's a lot more expensive than chicken. I hope it becomes tasty and satisfies the desires of people who want to eat meat without harming any animals. So I would favor that if it does become mainstream. And of course, I favor making plant-based foods, even if they're in a sort of meat-like texture, which again, I have no desire to eat more burgers in my life, really. If that's what people want to eat and you can provide it for them in a plant-based form and they'll enjoy it and it will be competitive in price, that would also be a good thing.
Yeah, I agree with that 100% for sure. Some people, you know, when I went vegetarian, I didn't do it because I didn't enjoy eating meat, because I did back then. It just, I think that the process of doing, I went vegetarian overnight, but I think it would have been easier for me if there had been things like Impossible and Beyond, because I would have just switched to those right away. So now I think people are pretty lucky that they have those options, and people who aren't interested in being vegan, like, there's still, I think, a good option for them, because they can do something better for the planet and for the animals by eating these foods, and at least start reducing the animals' suffering they are contributing to.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm a little different, because when my wife and I became vegetarian, we enjoyed exploring other cuisines. We had both, we're both of sort of Central European descent. And we both had that really meat-heavy Central European food in our homes when we grew up. And suddenly those things were out. So we started cooking Indian, Chinese, Middle Eastern, all of these things that have a lot, Mediterranean generally, a lot more non-meat alternatives. And that was really fun and exciting, and we enjoyed that. And that reminds me, by the way, that I do want to mention that Animal Liberation Now has a recipe section up the back.
Yes.
Which I write about, both about the things that we had at home when I was growing up that were vegan, but also about the other things that that I enjoy cooking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found that I got even more adventurous once I went vegan. So I was definitely exploring lots of vegetables and things like that when I was vegetarian. But when I went vegan, I really was like, okay, I'm going to start learning about all these different foods. And I did. And now I eat all kinds of cuisines I'd never had experienced before. And my menu is so much more plentiful and more interesting than it ever was when I was eating animals.
Yeah, there's a lot more variety, I think. I think a lot of people who eat meat just, you know, eat pretty boring food.
Yeah.
There's a lot more variety when you're eating vegetables and grains and legumes, lentils and beans and so on. You make an Indian dal one day. You make a Chinese stir fry with tofu another day. You do some falafel or pasta or something like that, a whole range of different things that you're more likely to do.
Yeah. One quick question before my final question. If someone came up to you and said, Peter, I want to figure out how to go vegan, but make it easy, what are three things you would tell them to start doing right now?
Yeah, so I would tell them to make dal, really. I think, you know, that was one of the first dishes that I cooked and enjoyed. It's really easy. And it's even easier than you think, because you can make a large quantity of it. It freezes really well. Mm-hmm. So yes, it, you know, it takes a little bit of time for the lentils to go soft and stir around, and you need to put in the spices and so on. But, you know, make four times as much as you're going to eat tonight, and put the rest away, and you've got meals for, you know, take it out once a week or something. It's great. Get the accoutrements if you can, if you have an Indian grocery near you. Get some papadums and some lime pickle or something like that, and have it with it. I think it's a really good meal. So that's one thing I would say. What else would I say? Well, I would say, you know, a lot of people have this negative reaction when I talk about tofu. But again, it comes in so many different forms. You can do so many different things. It absorbs flavors so well. I guess, you know, one of my favorite dishes is that Mapo tofu, which the Chinese do. Some places do it with pork, but it doesn't need the pork at all. Mm-hmm. It's a really spicy Sichuan dish. I really enjoy that. And there are a lot of other great Chinese dishes. If you like it spicy, there's that Sichuan eggplant dish. But there's also a lot of other Chinese, Japanese, Korean foods that are vegan or very easily can be made vegan. So I would say, you know, explore that cuisine as well.
Okay. So my final question, Peter, tell me about your favorite hummus or your favorite way to eat hummus.
Oh, okay. So the kind of hummus I follows on from what I was saying about Asian food. The kind of hummus I like is a little bit spicy, right? Okay. But it comes in these containers that has some oil on top and some spicy red powder around it. And the problem is you got to avoid the temptation to just scoop that off the top, because then the rest of it is a bit bland. So you do need to mix it in. Mm-hmm. But I like that on a really good crisp cracker. It's good. I bake bread. That's another thing that I might mention. I like to make my own bread. I've got a great recipe for bread, which I think originally came out of the Sullivan Street Bakery, it was called. So if you Google Sullivan Street Bakery bread recipe, you make it in a Dutch oven in one of those cast iron pots. And that produces, you do it half an hour, you bake it half an hour with the lid on and half an hour with the lid off. And that makes a terrific crust. And you don't have to knead. It's a no need, leave it overnight to rise recipe.
So nice. It's
very easy.
Yeah.
So you know, have the hummus on your freshly baked bread. It's even more delicious.
Oh my gosh, so good. Peter, this has been wonderful. I am so thankful that you were able to join me today and that you shared so much of your insight. And I'm sure that you've inspired listeners who will hear this. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kimberly. It's been great talking to you, and thanks for doing what you're doing with your podcast. It's wonderful to be reaching more people.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome back. I'd love to know what you're thinking. What did you learn? I am truly honored to have had this opportunity to chat with Peter like this. To connect with Peter, visit his website, petersinger.info. Follow him on Instagram at peter_singer, on Facebook at Peter Singer Official Page, and on Twitter at Peter Singer. As always, you'll find these links in the show notes. I hope you found this episode helpful and inspiring. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you're loving it, please give Did You Bring the Hummus a 5-star rating and leave a review. It's an easy way to keep supporting the show. Be sure to share these episodes with your friends. If you're finding something good here, they will too. If you're a vegan or know a vegan who would be a great fit for the podcast, follow the Be a Guest link in the show notes. Fill out the quiz and I'll be in touch. There's also a new contact page on the website. If you have questions, if there's someone that you're dying to hear interviewed on the podcast, if you just want to tell me something, please reach out via that contact link. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Did You Bring the Hummus, and visit my website, didyoubringthehummus.com, for more information about me, updates on what I'm working on, new podcast episodes, and all things vegan. Finally, I would love to hear from you. What do you need help with? Is there a topic you want to hear covered on a future episode? DM me on Instagram or send me an email at didyoubringthehummus@gmail.com. Season 5 is coming soon. Thanks for listening.